Morning. Great Lord's Day. It's nice to have a little shade, right? Instead of blistering sun. Yeah. All right. This morning, we want to take a look at the book of Job in our survey through the Bible. I mentioned last week that Job would be the first of what we refer to as the wisdom literature section in the Old Testament. He grew up in probably a Church of Christ children's Bible class. Over the years, you probably learned 5-12 division, right? 39 books in the Old Testament, 5 books of history or law at the beginning, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Then you've got 12 books of history. Yeah, 5 books of law, 12 books of history, 5 books of wisdom. 5 major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, maybe Lamentations in the middle of that. Then 12 minor prophets, all right? So there's your memory hook for the week. Did anybody else learn that? No? Well, I knew she probably did.
I couldn't do it today, but I could probably tell you what's in them.
Okay, there you go. I think there's the same kind of thing for the New Testament as well. I'm having trouble remembering. 4-1-21-1. There you go. Anyway. That's I think it's 10 or 11. Probably 11. That's where Lazarus...
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, somebody said, I can hear your word.
They're tricky, aren't they? All right, let's talk about the book of Job. You may not be aware of this, but Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, those books of wisdom. Not to say that the other books don't share wisdom of God, but in the book of Job, at least in my version, most of it is set apart in, it tells you that it's poetry, right? Because the setup in the Bible is different. You know, it's kind of written like poetry. The beginning of the book isn't part of that, and it's just your straight, you know, can't think of the word I'm trying to think of. A lot of Job is written in that. It doesn't come across to us in English. To the Hebrew listener, they would have heard that cadence just like we hear in English. You know, we can pick out poetry pretty well because it kind of rhymes in a way. Well, Hebrew had that kind of thing too. Translated in English, it doesn't work out quite as well to our ears. But the book of Job, if you've ever studied it before, you know, explores the deep mystery of suffering and God's sovereignty. In fact, suffering is going to be our theme for the book, or my theme for the book. And of course, the basis of the story, Job, a righteous man, is tested by Satan with unimaginable losses, his wealth, his children, and his health, yet he refuses to curse God. He has 3 friends stop by and sit with him for a week without words and maybe just horrified by the condition their friend is in. You know, if you will, Job sitting in an ash heap scraping his boils and wounds with, you know, something, or maybe a piece of pottery or whatever. Horrific scene. If maybe it would have been best if those men would have kept quiet, just been there for him. But after about a week, they start to talk, and then Job and these 3 men go back and forth, and his 3 friends are trying to accuse him of something wrong in his life, and that's why he's happened to suffer. And then finally, the book ends. God kind of sets everybody straight. But the book of Job presents the hard reality of living in this world. Sometimes righteous people suffer for no apparent cause. And that's been something humans have struggled with since time immemorial, right? And maybe you've battled that in your life. You've ever suffered before, and you can't, you know, most of us can endure a certain amount of suffering if we know we deserve it, right? You know, if I go out and do something wrong and get thrown in jail for it, well, I can kind of come to terms with that because, you know, I had it coming. But to suffer from what our vantage point looks like needlessly, that's hard to reconcile. Some people do curse God over it, right? and leads them to think, well, there can't be a God. If God truly loves me, like the Bible says he does, then why would he let me hurt like this? So that's kind of what's dealt with in these 42 chapters. The author of the book, like many we've seen already, is unknown. The events of the book of Job, you know, we've been kind of tracking a timeline historically speaking through these books, and we ended like Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, you know, some 400, 500 years before Christ. Job's going to take us clear back to patriarchal times, I believe. Again, you can get on the internet and get more debate about all of this than you probably care to read, but I believe, just from some of the hints in the storyline, that Job was probably a contemporary with Abraham back in those days, some 2,000 years before Christ. The Bible doesn't date the time of Job, but there is some internal references in the book that suggested he lived in the time of the patriarchs of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You've got the length of Job's life, 140 years after his trials ended. That's chapter 42, verse 16. So it's in the time when people were living longer ages. By the time you get to the post-exilic age, that wasn't happening that way. Then you've got some references. You know, Job's wealth is measured in terms of livestock, which is how Moses evaluated the wealth of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Thirdly, in chapter 1, verses 15 and 17, you've got mention of some people groups named the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans, and they were, of course, nomads during the patriarchal period, but not later. And then finally, scholars point to the fact that the Hebrew word for piece of money, or piece of silver, rather, in chapter 42:11 is found elsewhere only in connection with Jacob in patriarchal times. So that's just some of the reasons why people who are a lot smarter than me say Job was probably from that time period in Bible history. All right, let's go through the outline of the book. Again, no time to go verse by verse, obviously, in one class period through 42 chapters. But chapters 1 and 2 in the book of Job, we can title The Affliction of Job. This just tells the story of how this all got started, right? You know, Job is portrayed and called by the writer as a righteous man, fearing God, right? Turning from evil right away there in verse 1. He's got a house full of kids and property galore. And then you've got the story of the adversary coming to the counsel of God and asking for an opportunity to afflict Job. And again, that's in the realm beyond our eyesight and ears hearing, right? In the spiritual realm, some things are going on, and the accuser, or Satan as it's translated, kind of challenges God. Well, just let me work Job over here a bit, and we'll see how faithful he is to you, right? You claim he's such a righteous man. Well, just let him have some trouble in life, and we'll see how that works. And God, in his sovereignty and wisdom, allows Satan the opportunity not to touch Job, but to take basically everything away from him. And then it happens again, and Job is allowed to, or Satan is allowed to afflict Job personally. So you've got those, we're introduced to those players in the drama. Then in the main part of the book, chapters 3 through 41, you've got this discussion. After Satan's work is done, Job, again, is just kind of sitting in the ash heap. You know, his life has crumbled around him. His, you know, his kids are gone. His wealth is gone. His health is gone. So he pours out his heart, and you'll find this throughout the book of Job. In chapter 3 is one place. Job laments about his situation. In fact, I don't know if it's chapter 3, but somewhere in the midst of all, he says, you know, it would have been better off if I hadn't been born, right? And that's a dark place in life when you reach that point. Well, then you've got the accusation of these friends, and I'm going to put friends in quotes. Maybe you've had some friends like this. And, you know, I'm not going to question their motives. Perhaps, you know, they're practicing maybe some religion as they were taught. You know, there's got to be something bad going on here, or you wouldn't be afflicted. So that goes back and forth. Jim? Yeah, it's kind of like piling on, right? And you've got a man in the darkest place that he's ever been, and now the friends are heaping more burden upon him. How tragic. Yeah, be careful who you seek counsel from. We'll talk a little bit more about that before we're done. Anyway, this group of chapters 4 through 31, are this interchange that goes back and forth between Job and these three men. I'm using the outline from Norman Geisler in his survey book on the Old Testament. Anyway, he calls chapter 4 through 14 round one. You know, Job has some say, and anyway, you got Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, I think, are their names. Anyway, round two, chapters 15 through 21. Round three, chapters 22 through 26. And then, if you will, chapters 27 through 31, he calls Job's closing monologue. You know, I guess by that time, these three friends have kind of given up, from their perspective, trying to knock some sense into Job. He's not listening, just being obstinate, you know, that kind of stuff. So Job has kind of a say. Then you've got the intervention of someone named Elihu in chapters 32 through 37. And he's kind of a bridge between this bad counseling of the three friends and what God's going to have to say at the end. And he's kind of a mysterious character. He's just introduced out of the middle of nowhere. And he comes a lot closer to the reality of what's going on than the three friends did. And oddly enough, maybe not oddly enough, but when we get to the end, God doesn't say anything about Elihu. You've got God saying, your three friends haven't spoken what's right about me. So whoever this Elihu was, he comes closer to the truth. But the reality is, in chapters 38 through 41, you've got the revelation of the Lord. And here's, I always kind of envision it in my mind, you know, God's let Job and these three friends vent for the, you know, basically the whole book. And, you know, Job has thrown some, if you will, some pretty good punches at God. Why are you letting this happen to me? And on it goes. And now it's like God, starting in chapter 38, says, all right, I'm going to sit you down here, Job, and we're going to work through some things here. And it isn't like God gives him an answer to the question he has. Why, God? God never really says why, but he says, you need to remember your place in all of this, Job. And then chapter 42, it's amazing how quickly Job, if you will, comes to his senses. You know, he's endured all those middle chapters fighting back and forth with God and or with the three friends. And then when God has his say for three or four chapters, Job says something to the effect, God, I should have covered my mouth and been quiet about all of this. You've got repentance there in chapter 42, the first part, and then God restores him, chapter 42, at the end of the chapter. In fact, Job is, when all the dust settles from all of this story, Job is blessed even more richly than he was before. All right. As I said a while ago, I've just chosen the theme of suffering. I don't think you can get around this as the theme of this book, because suffering, if you will, oozes out all over. Physical suffering as well as mental stress. You know, Job's problems with suffering were more than just external. It was the agony he was going through, thinking, well, you know, I've lived my life faithfully to God, but yet these things are happening to me. In fact, maybe here's a theme verse I chose, chapter 14, verse 1. Here's what Job kind of summarizes at this point. He says, man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. Right? You know, maybe you felt that way before at some stressful time in your life. What's the use? Well, the book of Job records several different reactions to this problem of suffering. And we're just going to highlight a few of these this morning to tie this theme together. There's ways to approach this problem. Number one, you've got the reaction of Satan himself, this adversary in the heavenly council of God. Satan views suffering as a tool to tempt humankind to sin, right? If you were to ask Satan, I think that would be his answer, right? This is a good tool in my toolbox. If I can just get people to suffer enough to curse God and die, and we'll talk about that reaction in just a moment. But note in chapter 1, I think I hinted at this a little bit early. Chapter 1, verses 9 through 11. And this is right on the heels, of course, of verse 8, where God says, it's almost like God sets up Job, says, hey, have you considered Job, my servant? What a good guy. Well, verse 9, then Satan answered the Lord, chapter 1, verse 9, does Job fear God for nothing? And what's being implied there? Job just loves you, God, and follows you because he's got everything he wants. Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions and increased in the land, but Satan says, put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Again, suffering is just a tool. If Satan can get someone to suffer and abandon God, then all the better for his perspective. The next perspective would be, we talked about a moment ago, Job's wife. And again, she's suffered in this as well, not as much as Job perhaps, but she's lost her children as well. So, you know, when we heap, you know, scorn on her for her reaction, it's probably pretty human, right? She just tells Job in chapter 2, verse 9, her reaction to suffering is just to give up, right? What's the use? She encourages her husband to do that, and maybe she's already done it by that point. That's one way to deal with it, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, early on in the process, it might be in chapter 1, or shortly after that, Job says something like, well, God gives and God takes away. But as time stretches on, that doesn't serve Job as well as he thought it might. Yeah. Yeah, this is, again, as I said at the beginning, this is reality where humankind lives. Out of all the books in the Old Testament, we can relate to this because we've all maybe been at some level in this place. You know, I'm in the midst right now in my daily Bible reading for the year of going through the prophets, and you know, it's kind of a constant theme that you say, well, how does this relate to my life? Well, maybe not as well as some of this. Let's talk about the reaction of Job himself, and I've just characterized this Job with three, as Job tries to reconcile all that's happened to him. I've chosen three words: bewilderment, despair, and anger. And you see that in his responses as he talks to his so-called friends and he vents to God, right? He sounds bewildered at times. How can this be? You know, he sounds like he's despairing, and there's some anger flashes from time to time as you read the story. He says things like, why can't I just go ahead and die? That's really the theme of chapter 3. You see it in chapter 6, verses 8 and 9, chapter 7, verse 15, chapter 10, verses 18 and 19. He's, you know, that it's echoes of what we hear other, you know, faithful people throughout time. You reach a point, was it Elijah? He says, well, I'm the only one left, God. Just put me to death too and get it over with. There's one other example of that same kind of thing. Kendra mentioned Jonah. He was the other one I was trying to think of. That, you know, he says, "Well, you know, God took away the shade of what was the plant?" Anyway, he was ready to give up. Job felt that way. Job exclaimed several times throughout the book, "I'm innocent." You know, he was probably searching his mind, "What did I do?" You know, his friends were charging him with that. Sometimes it takes some years to have a perspective to deal with this. And yeah, I would echo the fact that if we're going to be counselors in these type of situations, please be careful of some of those canned answers that we tend to throw out there that you know, aren't much help. I mean, there may be a thread of truth to what we're saying, but it may not be helpful at that particular time. All right, let's... Job says, why can't I just go ahead and die? He says, I'm innocent, over and over again. There's places where, like in chapter 9 and chapter 10 and chapter 19 and chapter 30, Job in essence says it's unfair. It's unfair, God. And then he even claims in chapter 24, verses 1 through 12, he says, God, you're not paying attention. Right? So, you know, it's instructive here, I think, in this discussion, and boy, we are running out of time, that God, as Michelle pointed out, is still working with Job here. You know, Job, God doesn't fry Job to a crisp for questioning these things. He allows him room to vent. You've got Job's friends, and of course their perspective on suffering was that God is punishing Job for sin in his life. And then God's perspective, and he's the ultimate one. And I've just summarized God's reaction, because again, if you read chapters 38 through 41, there's really no place where God says to Job, this is why you're going through this. In essence, God's answer is that humans shouldn't forget their place in relation to God no matter what happens. Now, that's a bitter pill to take, but God knew this is what Job needed to hear at the time. God is sovereign. However, for whatever reason this is happening, just don't forget who you are, Job, and who I am. Let me go through my list of lessons, and we don't have time. Maybe these are just plant a seed in your mind to think about as you work through these things. Here are six lessons that I see from the book of Job. Number one is that God's ways are ultimately beyond human understanding. We have to acknowledge that fact. We can't get God all figured out, right? Again, as I've said before, our efforts to put God in a box are doomed. Yep, and that's what God did there at the end, didn't he? Job, where were you when I did this? You know, were you watching when I did this? You know, he's God, we're not. Number two, lesson two, even when suffering seems unfair, God's wisdom and justice remain perfect. As hard as it might be to work through that, that still remains true. Number three, Job's endurance teaches that faith can survive suffering and hardship. Never forget, through the struggle, and the book's mostly about the struggle Job went through, but the end result is that due to even the struggle, he remained faithful, and God rewarded him for that. Number four, human wisdom can be misguided, so that we should be careful with our judgments, and that goes back to what we discussed a few moments ago. Just be careful with the canned bumper sticker theology we have in helping people in these situations. Job's friends tried it, and it wasn't what, you know, God condemned them for it at the end. So be careful with all of that. Number five, we are called to be humble and to trust in God's work even when we don't have all the answers. Right? And that's the hardest part of all. Sometimes God gives us an answer and explains why this is going on. Or we have some examples of that. Other times, God is doing maybe something that we'll never get, but we still can trust God in that. Then finally, remember that suffering is not always a punishment. It's easy to fall into that trap in life, that, well, things are going bad, then that must mean that God doesn't love me anymore, or that he's punishing me for this or that. That's bad theology. So it may be true, but it may not be true. All right, time's up. Thank you for, I hope everybody had a chance to say what they wanted to say. A lot to cover there, but let's make plans next week to move into Psalms. So there's some good stuff there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Mm-hmm.